Calvin Rutstrom, tape one.
But former Governor Regan said, she says, you've seen one tree, you've seen them all.
Yeah.
So I wrote a letter to him one day, and I said, you've been accused of making this statement.
The difference is every Tuesday.
I heard him make it on TV.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't say that. So I wrote to him and I said, is it possible that you made this statement? No, he wrote back and denied it entirely. He never made that statement. I heard him make it on TV.
You can tell the difference of a tree. I had an experience with a nursery. I bought a pine tree. It was a railway pine. And they were waiting for them to deliver it. I ordered it, and finally they delivered the tree. And when they had it laying down, when they put it up there, I could see it wasn't my tree. But I picked out. You know, there's a difference in trees. I could tell.
Yeah.
And so I said, that's not my tree. So I said, I'm going to follow you out and see if that tree that I picked out is still out there. Sure enough, it was still out there, tagged, you know. And so they just, I heard afterwards, they just leave them there for like a car place where they leave certain cars in the showroom, you know. Mm-hmm. And then they bring people other trees, and most people, I guess, don't complain about it. You know?
Yeah.
They were doing that. So I got my attorney to roll in my on my tree. So then they come to the side, they said, well, come out and pick out, you know, come out, make sure you're getting your tree. I come out there and they had sold my tree.
Yeah.
So then they let me pick any tree I wanted because they were so embarrassed. So I picked it, pretty good. It's funny how they try to get away. So isn't that, you can tell the difference. Every tree has a certain character about them, you know. They're different.
Sure, you can identify it. Individual tree when you buy it.
Grow better.
Yeah. Yeah, I bought a. I went down in a secondhand place in Washington Avenue one day and bought a trunk. Needed a trunk to ship a bunch of stuff up. But there was a beautiful fiber, light colored trunk there. And I asked him what he told me what it was. And I paid him for it in advance, and when he made the delivery, he delivered another trunk. And I went down there, and he claimed that I bought this other trunk. I didn't even see these other trunks. Just showed him this one. So I told him I was going to expect him to deliver that other trunk, or I'd take it down to conciliation court. And he stuck with it. He had used this trunk to sell many other trunks, you know.
Sure.
When he delivers them, he delivers another trunk. It made me pretty mad, and I got very retaliatory. So one day I call him up on the telephone, and I said, how would you like to pick up a whole house full of furniture? I said, it's old furniture, but it's good furniture. I said, you could probably sell it and make some money on it. And I give him an address way the hell gone out of Wood Lake. And when he got out there, there was not even a house there. And I called him back. He had paid $18 to have this fellow drive out there with a big semi truck, you know, to get all this furniture. Told me he'd be $18 for this truck, and there wasn't no such address. I said, well, what address did you write down? Oh, I said, he needs something nice. Ah, that's wrong. I said, if you don't come out, I said, listen now, get a pencil and paper and write this down. So I wrote it down, and I went out there to see where, in the area where he was, where he came, and sure enough, he sent that big semi out another $18, $36. Only paid $5 for the trunk. So he paid $36 and he got out there, and there wasn't anybody out there with a house full of furniture. And what he said to me was, when I told him that he gave me the wrong trunk. He says, "Have you got a receipt?" I didn't have a receipt for anything, you see. And so when I called him back the second time, he said, "I sent the man out, I paid $18 and so forth." And I said, "Have you got a receipt?" And then he knew who I was. So it cost him $36, or he could have delivered the right trunk in the first place. He just got better than hell and retaliated.
And then he said, "Huh?"
I think he was out about somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 for his crookedness. Are we taping all this?
I'm going to start now if you're
set. Anytime, sure.
Okay. First of all, I wanted to ask you about your new book, Chips from Wilderness Log. What was the inspiration for...
I suppose we better have it pretty quiet here if we're going to tape, though. Huh?
Yeah.
Dear?
Yes? Okay,
how can you... we're going to have a noiseless operation here, but how do you want to work it?
Might go out and sit outside a second.
Okay, it doesn't...
Yeah, we ought to come back.
And take something along to cover ourselves, or...
Oh, you're going to sit out there on the porch?
Yeah, we'll sit out there.
Well, you've got all kinds of robes here and quilts and
stuff here.
I was going to ask you your new book about chips for the wilderness, from a wilderness
chips
log.
Chips from a wilderness log.
What was the inspiration behind that?
Well, it's kind of a play on words. The point of it is that we use figurative language so much nowadays. That I thought associated with the wilderness and... even through the book, I refer to this chip and that chip and so forth, and that seems to be well understood. I thought that we needed some kind of a book with a lot of anecdotes, little humor, information, just a hodgepodge of everything, where they could open the book in the middle if they wanted to and read some chip, as you say. And we had a book pretty well lined up, but it was largely in chapters. This was not exactly what chips would imply, because we're getting parts of a log rather than chips, so we get it cut into chapters. So I thought, why not a lot of little anecdotes, quarter of a page, half a page, full page, maybe several pages early. So we got some, about 125 different little episodes we got in there. And it seems to be accepted quite generally so far. We had one review where they were a little disturbed about one of the chapters in there, and I suppose that they were also a little disturbed by the hunting and fishing episodes in there, where they thought maybe the fishermen and the hunters might be hurt, you know, if they're using too much conservation, so to speak. But otherwise, the book seems to be well accepted.
Have all of your books been received also sort of antagonistic reception from certain groups?
No, on the contrary, of course, when I first wrote Way of the Wilderness. In fact, I even asked the editor if he'd like to have a chapter on fishing and on hunting. And he wrote back and he said, by all means, no. He said, fishing stories and hunting stories are 10 cents a dozen, he said. They go to sporting magazines who teach you 30 ways to kill something. And so he frowned on it. And so in order to say something about hunting and fishing, I submitted two chapters, Hunting for Food and Fishing for Food, and this was on the expeditionary type of thing, or the long trek, the long canoe journey. This went over all right. And it kind of appeased the hunter too, you know, so he figured that you weren't anti-gun, see?
Without a doubt, though, you probably must have been a fairly good hunter.
Well, I was never a sportsman in the sense. My canoe trips lasted about 7 weeks. And during that time, of course, we'd live off the country somewhat. And so my hunting was limited to just barely what I needed to take to make some of these long journeys feasible. Otherwise, I was never a hunter in any sense of the word. And it always hurt me to kill something anyway. In fact, when they talk about fishing, well, this is a very conventional type of thing, and people think in terms of limits and so forth. And they say, well, this fish gave me a real fight. Well, it was a kind of a one-sided battle, because here is a poor fish, not fighting, but struggling for his life on the end of a line with a hook in his mouth, and the fisherman is sitting in the boat smoking a pipe while he's tugging away at this poor fish trying to survive, and the battle seems to be a little one-sided there.
Could you give me an idea of what sort of equipment you would take on, say, a 7-week canoe journey?
Well, you're referring to equipment in general.
Yeah.
Well, of course, you're going to have to live out there, and you're going to have to be housed, so to speak. So you've got a tent, and the tent should be quite let's say it's got to be a tent of many variables in order to go through the kind of weather you have, because if the sun is shining all the time and it's not raining, you really wouldn't need a tent. But the sun may be shining all day and the evening may be star-studded, but by the time that you get to bed, there may be a downpour, so you take a tent. But the trouble with most of these tents are that they're just little dog houses that you crawl into when it's raining. And some people refer to them as little rag houses that they crawl into. The tent that I have is really a tent or wedge tent that I have modified to take in all kinds of weather. In other words, I have split the ends of the tent to the ridge on both ends. Now this enables the tent to be pitched, and if you start getting a wind, we'll say from the east, you can raise the west side of the tent up, form a canopy. Now you're living under a canopy, you can cook and carry on, even have a fire on there while it's raining, because the sparks aren't going to ignite the tent. So what you're doing there is carrying on your domestic life, so to speak, and you're enjoying yourself. If you have to crawl into a tent and wait for the rain to quit, you may have to wait, like I did, well, not necessarily like I did, but like it happened to me one time, 29 days, it rained 29 days, sometime during the day without stopping. That would make a canoe trip absolutely impossible. Now, if the wind should shift, you can pitch that side down, lift the other side. Or you can move it toward the forest so that the canopy that you're using is toward the forest, and the trees would prevent the rain from driving into your tent. So you have a very comfortable living space, the tent. Well, the tent was so successful that the United States government adopted this standard equipment for their people in Alaska. And but we're having a serious difficulty in this tent business. The state of Minnesota, or the state legislature rather, passed a bill that all tents have to be fire retardant, flame retardant, because some youngster in his backyard used candles, they set fire to the tent, and he was seriously burned. So they come out with one sweeping piece of legislation to have all tents flame retardant. Well, there is no flame retardant compound for this light tent material. You have about a 4.5 ounce material that's used for these backpacking and canoe tents. And there is a compound that's available, but it's like asking you to make a bucket out of the plastics that you would use for dentures. That would be, make a good bucket. It would also cost you $200 for a bucket, which is a little prohibitive on my budget anyway. The result is that there is no compound that you can use on that light material. I can show you some of the material that's coming out now with flame retardant compounds, and it's heavy canvas, or rather at least an 8 ounce canvas. It's loaded with a clay compound. So what makes the material heavy is lead. And they have discovered now that that compound that they put in the canvas, it falls out of the tent and causes permanent lung damage. In spite of that, they have gone ahead with this legislation. Now, the compound that they've got in there is flame retardant, but it's not fireproof. So that if you do have any kind of a fire in the tent, whatever it happens to be, the smoke, excuse me, the smoke from this material being scorched, it doesn't really have to burn much, would kill you. It'd asphyxiate you. So that the material that they're using in tents now is more of a hazard than if it were not flame retardant.
So much for progress.
Yeah. Now, I've taken this up with the legislature, and they ignore you. They have taken the attitude that they're infallible, and they pass a piece of legislation that it's there to stay, and it's sealed in stone and gold and so forth, so you can't etch it out anymore. The result is that they have virtually destroyed the light camping program. We don't feel it now, but as soon as these earlier tents that were made by the millions have worn out and people can't get a hold of these, young people buy these tents from elder people because they're through camping, you might say, they don't want to brave the storm anymore. So they do get a hold of some of these tents, but we're going to begin to feel the pinch pretty soon, And then the only tents that they can get are these canvas, clay-filled type of flame-retardant tents. And instead of them weighing 5-6 pounds, it'll weigh 35 pounds. And that's too heavy. You can't have a 35-pound tent and carry your provisions and other camping equipment on your back and expect to make a trip through the mountains. And if you're going to go over portages and your tent weighs 35 pounds alone, and you begin to add to that your other camping equipment, you have inhibited yourself badly on portages. So I don't know what the final result will be. The people who manufactured my tent in St. Paul, they've tried every conceivable means of trying to get a hold of tent materials, light tent materials that are reasonably fire retardant, but they can't even get a hold of the light materials anymore. You can get them from Japan, but you have to buy 20,000 yards. And if you buy 20,000 yards and you find that you can't even sell them, you're prohibited by law to sell them, you're in trouble. Now, there are some states that don't have this law, and we're trying to indoctrinate these states in such a way that they won't fall for this stuff anymore. But I don't know what luck we're going to have. Now you've got, that's just one item in your camping. And you have your set of cooking utensils, your nesting cooking utensils. And nowadays you have to take along some small type of gasoline stoves, pocket-sized type, you might say. Primus from Sweden make a lot of them. And because you're going to have periods when you're not allowed to build a fire in the forest, so you have to take this along, which is a kind of an addition to the thing. Then you'll have to have a sleeping unit for each individual. And I'm still sticking to the down. There's a great deal of other imitation type of things.
They even have a synthetic down.
They have a synthetic down now?
Yeah.
I mean, they call it synthetic down, or is it a synthetic?
They call it down, and then you'll notice on the instructions that it's down is made of 35% polyethylene or things
oh,
like
yeah.
that.
Well, that's probably a fraud, huh?
Yes, yeah.
That's the word. The people who are manufacturing, of course, these various fibers can sell a sleeping bag for a lot less money than a down sleeping bag, of course. Most of our down, the good down, came from China, where they raised a great many geese. But now China has realized the commercial value of making down sleeping bags. So they're making their own units now instead of shipping the down out to different people to manufacture. But most of these, they're like the polyester type of sleeping bag. For the average summer trips, they're all right. And but when you get into camping where it reaches into September and October, you're liable to have even a snowfall, and you know, to have a sudden drop in temperature. I like the down. Of course, one of the arguments in favor of these synthetic fibers is that they will dry out quicker than the down. Well, I've camped for better than 60 years, and I've never had a wet sleeping bag yet. It isn't necessary to get anything wet if you handle your equipment right. If you, for example, when you come into come into camp and it's raining, the first thing you'll put up is your tent and you'll unpack under cover. And if it's not raining, there's a certain advantage in method in not putting up your tent until the last thing. But all the way through on this camping process, you can camp for days and weeks and in rain and still not be wet. You have a wet tent. You have rain equipment to cover your body. And this has gotten to be quite a farce now, too. They use waterproof pants and a waterproof shirt. And condensation that you get in the pants, you might as well stand out in the rain without anything, because perspiration that you lose in 3 hours is usually about from a pint to a quart. And we use the best thing that's available is a rain shirt with a rain hat. And even in the summertime, a lightweight four buckle overshoe, for the simple reason that you're going to walk alongside your canoe on a beach and load it. You have to walk out into 3, 4, 5, 6 inches of water. It's convenient that way. But these rain shirts with a hood on them are an abomination, for the simple reason that if you're sitting in that canoe and your partner says, look over there at the shore, there's a moose, or you look and you turn your head and you're looking into a blind alley. And if you tighten the hood down so that it isn't free to for your head to move around, what happens is that the water will run down on your face and into the head, the hood, and down into your body. You can't avoid it. You'd have to have a tight seal here, which you can't. So I cut the hood off on all of these rain shirts and use a rain hat, one of those old, what they call, sou'westers. And I'll admit it isn't perfect equipment, but it certainly is a big improvement over. And then when you sit in a canoe with the rain shirt, the rain shirt comes down over your feet, so you don't have anything, you don't have any problem getting your footwear or your knees or any other part of your body wet. So the rain shirt, the sou'wester hat, about a lightweight four buckle overshoes, I found the best thing. Now you can, think about an overshoe, you can leave them unbuckled in the canoe if you want to wear them, continue to wear them in the canoe. And in case you should upset, but you're a good canoe, capable canoe person, you would certainly not upset, no matter how rough the water is, but there is a chance of upsetting. And if you've got footwear on that you can't take off or can't kick off, you're very apt to drown, because it acts as weights on your feet. You wouldn't be able to swim. So you can kick them off. And in an emergency. But what I wear is I showed you that moose, that smoke tan moose hide. I wear a moccasin, and I wear the moccasin in the four buckle overshoe. So I kick the overshoes off anyway. I'm not sitting in the canoe, so I'm sitting in there with a pair of moccasins. And if it's raining, there's a chance to be water on the floor of the canoe, of course, and I just keep the overshoes on. So each little division of your camping equipment has got to be worked out so that it doesn't make life miserable for you when you're out there.
Do people generally take too much equipment along with them?
They take too much in the wrong kind, so they're in trouble. And there are a vast number of canoe trips that start and they think that they're properly equipped. They go through it and get into bad weather, and that's the last of the canoeing. That happens so frequently. And somehow people think that the norm is bright sunlight, calm water, and everything's sweet and lovely. Right here in the St. Croix, for example, we have examples of what happens. They'll come up the river in a canoe, and they'll rent a canoe, and they'll put their provisions and so forth in a corrugated cardboard box, and they're going to spend the day up the river, and they even start out many times without any rain gear of any kind. I came down the river one evening, and there was a girl and her younger brother on the trip, and they had their food in a corrugated box, and the thing had just flattened right out. The food was the sugar, and the whole business was all one mess in the bottom of the canoe. And it was quite cold, and they were terribly disappointed. And we were camped along the shore. And I kind of felt sorry for them. I thought what they needed was knowledge more than they needed anything else. And we had a good fire going, and in spite of the fact that it was drizzling, you can keep the fire going in the average rain without being put out if it's just a drizzle. So I asked them to come ashore, and we gave them a little lunch and gave them a little talk, and they went away. And I saw them about 3 weeks later on the river, and they were pretty well equipped. They had started up. But the way they were going down that river when we first saw them, hell bent for election to get home, get out of this terrible, miserable outdoors, you know. But I'm glad we stopped them, because we probably saved them from quitting the camp routine forever.
Has there been any single book that has established your reputation more than others?
My own book say that The Way of the Wilderness was the initial book that helped me more than any other. For example, I just wrote that book as a manual for Camp Lincoln and Camp Lake Hubert when I had the contract with them as the wilderness program director. And then Macmillan saw this book, and they wanted to know if I would write a book for them. This was a kind of a soft paper and cloth cover. Cloth was just glued to a soft paper. And then it was in an envelope, so with a snap on it. They could put it in their pack sack and use the cookbook end of it in there, or any other information they wanted to get out in the field. And the company, this is a youth camp, I say, they took 500 copies, and then other camps began to take several hundred copies, and it did pretty well. Then the Macmillan Company saw the book, and they had a great demand for that particular type of a book, which was pretty much the universal information that you might want for both summer, winter, and other kind of camping. And the Burgess Publishing Company in Minneapolis were printing it. Are they still in existence?
I believe they are.
And their editor was a pretty good friend of mine. In fact, he'd been on a dog sled trip with me up in James Bay. And so I said, would it be possible? You see, they couldn't give the proper discount for these books. I guess they only were giving 20% or something like that, because they were selling to schools and so forth. So I asked them if they would release me from that book, and I would rewrite the book for Macmillan, and then the camp could use it, and the public could get a chance to buy it. After some difficulty, they finally did release me from it. So I wrote this book, and we couldn't use Way of the Wilderness. We had to use the New Way of the Wilderness, which I didn't like because I didn't think the wilderness was new anyway. It's been here for 4 or 5 million years. And with the result that Macmillan published the book, and they had a good sale right away. I don't know how many of the copies they printed, but along came the Outdoor Magazine Book Club. They wanted Outdoor Life Book Club, I guess they called it. Anyway, they were using the book as a premium for a subscription. So instead of paying $3 or $4 for a subscription, you pay $8 and you got the book and this whole package. And well, they wanted my permission to use it as a premium, and I saw no reason why not. They took 52,000 copies right off of the bat. Heck, I was in business. I thought this beats working for a living. And then the book, somehow or other, just because of this Outdoor Book Club thing, got to selling better too. So I think that was probably the greatest stimulus of all of them. Mm-hmm. And then they had a great demand for a book on wilderness cabins. And the one that they were selling was a book that was written by Chilson Aldrich. And I don't know whether any of Dara Aldrich's fiction is still in existence, but she was writing fiction. And Chilton Aldrich was a log cabin builder on the north shore of Lake Superior. Beautiful cabin builder. Oh, he made some of the most wonderful cabinets. What he would do is take the white pine bark and he'd remove it from the trunk of the tree. And then he would saw the trunk up into slabs where he could put the bark back on the slab. But he would let the thing dry, and then he would glue the bark back onto the slab. And that would form the drawers. And he'd bevel them, you know. And so you had this bark-covered drawer. It made a very interesting thing. Cabinets were all bark covered and beveled off at the edges, and the bark would stay on there forever, you know. Otherwise it would get rotten and fall off of there because the sap under there, you know, would just eventually decompose the bark. And so they had this book called The Real Log Cabin, and I guess it had a good sale. And Chilson Aldrich, I think, died. And I don't know whether Zara Aldrich lived at that time either. But Macmillan says, we've had this book. We need a cabin book. He says, we have writers, we have cabin builders, and we have people who are interested in the wilderness, but we can't think of anybody but you who had a combination of all three. So if you can write us a book on the cabin. Well, I glad to do it because it looked like another successful book. They had a successful sale, and for some reason, I don't know why, the sales began to drop off. But I wrote a book on the log cabin, the frame cabin, the adobe cabin, the whole thing. And sales began to drop off. And they wrote me a letter and they said, unless you take a reduction in royalties, you'd have to discontinue publication, or we'll sell you the plates and you can have somebody else publish it. So I wrote back and I said, I'll take the plates. They wanted to sell them to me for $290, I think. Well, I didn't get to hear from them. All of a sudden, Esquire and a number of these very outstanding magazines start talking about the home away from home. the home in the St. Lawrence River, where people had $150,000 cabins stuck away, you know, while they were living otherwise in New York City or someplace. And they had, everybody was interested in having a cabin someplace, wilderness. They're getting tired of the urban stress, I guess. So they wrote up these articles, and Esquire gave me a half a page. Other magazines, big magazine, gave me. The next year, 60,000 copies went off the press. And here they were going to. So I wrote back and told them, I said, you wrote to me and told me that I could buy the plates. You are, in contract essence, responsible to sell me those plates. Didn't hear from him. I was just kidding him, of course. But I said, I want the plates. And I said, looks like it's going to be a little fortune, and I want your profit and my profit too, since you don't want to publish the magazine or the book anymore. Not a word. Ordinarily, they'd call me up on the telephone from something, you know, it was in question. Not a word.
How many log cabins do you suppose you've built?
Oh, I haven't built so many. I suppose the thing about it is that you do part of it too, you know. Mm-hmm. Up at camp, I had a contract with the camp up there for 10 years, and we just keep building log cabins one right after the other, and haul them away somewhere. And the idea was to give the kids this knowledge. And we'd have caught log cabins up to our ears, you know, up there if we didn't get rid of them. So what they would do, the kids would get so they could almost build them themselves, you know, with just my supervision. So you see, you're only partially into the thing. But my earlier log cabins were built with a bark on them, you know. You could spend the winter up there, and you'd throw up a single room log cabin with a shed roof on it, you know. And those, built one every fall, someplace, different place. All you do is to cut a rough notch into the log. It wouldn't shape it or anything. Just drop the next log in there and cut through that halfway, and just keep piling them up. You know, very simple. And where the openings would show up, you know, from poor construction or from rapid construction, you just pack them with moss. You see, and same way the chinking, you chink them with moss and tar paper roof, and that was it. You had a good, put a stove in there. You wouldn't put the stove pipe through the roof, you put the stove pipe through the window, because you couldn't properly caulk around the pipe with just a tar paper roof. So you'd run it through, so it went out there about 4 feet, and got an elbow and up in the air, and you'd probably have to prop it up out there with couple of poles, you know. But we went through the winter beautifully.
Very functional.
Yes, very practical. And it doesn't take, you can build one of those cabins completely in about 4 or 5 days, you know. It isn't difficult at all.
Were all the ideas for your book suggested to you by publishers?
No. The only one that was suggested was the Wilderness Cabin. And that's been going good ever since. Now I'm trying to get them to revise the Wilderness Cabin because, there are quite a few modern building ideas that people can use instead of using individual rafters nowadays. You know, they go to the lumber yard and get this assembly all made. Then there are quite a few, what you call synthetic log cabins, where they run them through a machine, you know, and square them up, and all kinds of. In fact, they're building houses that way too. So, and these joints are all cut with a machine, so all they have to do is to just pile one up, one on top of the other. And they've got about a 3 or 4 inch fiberglass strip that they put in between there and then drop the log down it. No chinking. It's all taken care of. They're not very warm. One thing about a log cabin is kind of disillusioning in one way is that it's not a very warm cabin unless you strip it on the inside and insulate it on the inside. Of course, your romantic effect is for the outside anyway, but you need to strip it, insulate it, panel it on the inside, and then you've got a good cabin. But personally, if I were going out to build a cabin in the wilderness someplace, I would stick to the frame cabin. It's more functional, as you talk about, all the way through. But there's a certain romance that goes with a log cabin, and many people who know all the good and bad points of a log cabin build log cabins anyway, just because they want to do it for novelty's sake. But our neighbor up there on Washington Lake, he was a retired contractor from Wisconsin, retired quite young, at age 50, I think, somewhere around there. And he built a cabin out behind his main cabin just for the joy of making it one of almost perfection in the workmanship. The logs look as though they're poured together rather than notched together. So I wouldn't discourage people from building a log cabin, but if they're looking for a really warm building, that is not it. You see, as the log comes around to the lower end where they join, there's only about 2 or 3 inches of wood right there. And 2 or 3 inches of wood isn't going to give you much insulation. Even when you're building log cabins out of these great big Norway pine logs, you still don't have more than about 6 or 7 inches there. But that's only wood. And now there's all sorts of ideas coming into existence. Now they're talking about using a standard log, cutting a piece out of the center and putting the insulation in between. You know what I mean? It looks exactly like a log cabin inside and outside, but it's got 4 inches of insulation in between. And it's a material that is wood, but it's been all chewed up into fine little pieces and got a lot of air spaces and so forth. It makes pretty good insulation. So, they're trying every conceivable thing.
But still trying to get the look.
Yeah, the look of the log cabin. But it seems to me if you're going to have a little tradition, you better start with a real log and make a real log cabin out of it.
In your writings, had you consciously attempted to cover all the facets of wilderness living?
Oh, yes. Yes, even in the book, The Wilderness Cabin, you not only go into the construction of it, but you go into the equipping of it and the living in there and the psychology that goes with it and so forth. So it got to be a pretty good book. I think I'm going to, if I can get Macmillan to revise this thing, I'm even going to get in a little more of the psychological side, because I think people like to read about it. They think in terms of getting away from the grind, you know, and getting up into an area where there are no troubles anymore.
Have your books required much editing by the publishers?
No, the last book got quite a lot of editing in a strange way. I suppose that it cuts down on the number of words, but they wouldn't use "you will." It'll be "you'll." You know what I mean? And hooking these words together, it'd be probably more of a natural conversation, you know. And it'll come out all right. Instead of saying, it will come out all right. They don't want the it will, it'll come out all right. You know, they'll sort of chop off those two words and put a... And they did a lot of that. They wanted a lot of that in there. They thought it'd give it more natural. So I let it go. I protested most of the editing they've done. For example, strange as it may seem, when I wrote the book on Paradise Below Zero, the winter wilderness book, I mentioned in there that we in our conventional life eat more fat than the Eskimo does. When you take your pie and your cake and your donuts and your suet puddings and cookies and the ice cream, the whole bit, you eat about twice as much fat as the Eskimo does. He usually eats about 1/6 or 1/7 fat, but they think they live on blubber. So I've named up all the whole paragraph in there about all the fats that we have: butter, lard, French fried potatoes, and the whole business. We just glut ourselves with fat. People don't realize it when they're eating all this stuff, but they realize it when they're getting into troubles, physical, clinical trouble. But the editor wanted to delete that I would offend too many people. And it disturbed me a little bit, you know, because I knew what I was talking about. And I wrote back and I said, apparently there are too many things in the book that are really concrete truths, I says, that will offend your reader. I said, you might just as well send the whole manuscript back. Well, they didn't hear anything more about it, and they printed it as it was.
Are there a number of wilderness or outdoor writers that you respect?
There are not very many that actually write on the outdoors and do a major job of covering the field. Strange as it may seem, there should be more of them, but there's an awful lot of gadget type of writing. And this sells books pretty well. For example, I stick to a prospector model of a canoe. No matter who makes it. Now Grumman makes an 18 and a 20-foot prospector model. Now this is designed to take the heavy seas and so forth, and so constructed that you've got the least amount of material for the greatest capacity. And when you don't take everybody's canoe in existence into consideration, I might say, then you're losing book sales. But you have a more permanent, more realistic approach to the thing, and I think it's more durable. I think it will last longer because this gadget type of thing. Now we're into a problem now about canoes in revising this North American canoe country. You've got a lot of people making canoes, wood strip canoes and so forth. And what they're doing is making a canoe where the bow is compressed quite a lot. It's narrower. The theory is that this will cut the water. Didn't we discuss this here?
That part of it, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So we have that part to contend with, that those who come out with all kinds of canoes and the manufacturer's point of view and so forth, rather than bringing it down to a technical analysis, you're going to sell less books than you would be if they got all of the synthetic materials in there and all of the different shapes. So you have a long chapter with 20 different kinds of canoes in it. This makes a greater appeal to a lot of readers, but I don't think it's going to last very long. I think the book is like probably a flash in the pan book of fiction. It's here today and gone tomorrow. It gets to be kind of a catalog. I break down everything I do in the wilderness in principle. Try to break it down as scientifically as possible. And the same way with tents. 50 different model tents, and they're all just basically little doghouses you crawl into. When you talk about the convertible tent, to fit any type of weather and circumstance, you injure people's feelings. They talk about their little mountain tent or their little such and such a tent and so forth and so on. And I don't think you sell as many books, but I think you keep on selling the book, because as the years go by, fads drop off and principles stay.
You say there aren't a lot of wilderness writers who present.
No, there aren't very many wilderness writers when you come to think about it. And the reason for it is because there aren't very many people with wilderness experience. As I mentioned in one of my books, and I might have mentioned it to you before when you were here, that you can criticize a man's religion, you can criticize his wife, or his home and everything else, but if you criticize his camping, you're in trouble. He goes out on a 2-week canoe trip and he thinks he's learned it all. And this is what you run into all the time. Somehow or other, there must be something very basically primitive about this camping that makes a man want to have his antediluvian ancestors rise up in his body and say, here, I know everything, you know, there used to be no one. As I mentioned here before, when we had those tests up there on Lake Superior with the canoe, the people didn't go away saying, well, I've resolved this one problem, I've often wondered about this. Instead of that, they go away mad, because they've been injured. Their ideas have been injured. So when you put an outboard motor on their type of canoe and put one on a prospector canoe, same amount of freight, everything exactly the same, and you switch the motor back and forth so there isn't any question about how the wind was at that particular time, and you find you outrun them so radically bad that they must say, geez, I didn't realize that this was so. Nope, they get mad. Sure, they just get mad. They're old. The whole world is worrying about one thing above all others, and that's self-esteem. People kings have sent great armies to war, slaughter, because of their self-esteem has been injured in one way or another. You can talk politics until you're black in the face, but if you injure a politician's self-esteem, he's through with you. And so I would say, if I were ever running for office, and I think I mentioned this to you once before, I would appeal to their emotions. I'd fill up an auditorium with people if possible. I'd say, I don't want you to think that I'm apple polishing now, but this looks to me like one of the greatest audiences that I have ever appeared before in my life. And if you don't believe it, don't believe it. I believe it. See, you're a marvelous crowd. This is what you're going to see. But if you get in there and you start talking about issues and so forth, you'd be boring the people to death. So I'll tell you, the backslapping is the thing to do if you want to appeal to people. And don't fight their ideas. You can put them in books and as fundamental principles, and you'll do all right. But you won't do as well as if you put in a lot of bunk in there. Emotional bunk.
You moved to the Southwest for a while, didn't you?
No, we didn't move to the Southwest. We left here about February 15th and took in the Southwest half of February and all of March. As it got close to April, if the weather got too hot down there, which it often does, we took off to the north. Many years we'd come up here and the snow would still be on the ground, but it was 95 and 100 down there. It was getting where the sun's declination was such that you were out there baking in the sun and at a temperature of 90, 95, you know. So we went there for 6 weeks at a time for about 7 years, and that was the end of that. We could have the Southwest. I like the mountains down there, but I don't like the sandstorms. I brought a toolbox down there that was so tight, I don't see how an ant could possibly get into that toolbox unless you drill a hole in it. And do you know that when I would go to use a tool, it would be just loaded with that microscopically fine dust. And when I'd use an axe on some of that pinyon pine down there, you do it at night, and it made something like a 4th of July display, because sparks were flying from that wood. And the axe blade would have an edge that would look more like a hacksaw if you've been using it for a while. And there were so many. And we'd get so much sand in the keyhole of our house that you couldn't get the key in there. You couldn't lock the door. And even though we had a weather strip at the bottom of the door, there'd be a nice little mound of Sahara sand inside of the house. How would we get in there? I don't know. We just peek up like that. I like, and the rivers, there aren't any rivers down there that could possibly warrant the name river. They're shallow sand bottoms that are exposed most of the time. Now the Colorado, of course, has water in it, but most of the rivers down there, the Rio Grande, the Pecos, all of those rivers there, they're about an inch deep. Sand bottom.
You also.
So we just gave up on the Southwest. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, you also, as you mentioned before, spent time riding a fence in Montana.
Oh yeah, and when I was 16 years old, I went out to Montana.
Did you have ideas of becoming a cowboy out there?
Well, hopefully, you know. I was on the. I had $25. I spent $24 of it to go out west, and I got as far as Reigate, Montana. And I had a dollar left. And even in those days, prices for meals were quite high. I never expected to pay anything like 55 cents for a meal. It's usually, you know, 35 cents. You could go down some of these restaurants in Minneapolis in those days, and for 35 cents, you got meat and potatoes and salad and a piece of pie for 35 cents. But I went. So we spent quite a lot of time along this river, and one day he came up here with a fellow that had a nerve problem. He was He was a student at the University of Minnesota. He was quite young. But he had a tremor in his hands. And somehow or other, this fellow was a little proud, you know. He didn't want to be seen too much around with this thing. But he had studied too hard or something. So the psychiatrist over there had told him that he'd get away from the school for a while. And this fellow named George Gulden at Stillwater, he told me that this fellow had had this problem and so forth, but he did it without mentioning this other fellow's presence. And I got to talking to him, to this fellow with a nerve problem, and he's quite interesting. He was a well-educated fellow and a great reader and so on. Whereas he was supposed to go with George Gulden, and there was another fellow in the group, I forgot to mention that. I was supposed to go with this other fellow, and George Gulden and this fellow with a nervous problem was going to go together. But I kind of steered it around so that he would be in my canoe. And after we'd been on the river for quite a while, he began to tell me about his own problem. And he said he had to stay somewhere, in some natural place, and get away from the studies and so forth, because this is causing his problem. Well, I said, I'm just up here working on my cabin now and then. I said, why don't you spend some time with me? So he came up here, and we spent quite a few weeks together here. And we spent it all on the river, all the way from here to Solon Springs, Wisconsin. And he got over this thing while he was here. He went on back to school, and I didn't hear from him for 20 years. And one day, Florence got a hold of me. I was someplace, a long-distance call or something, I can't remember. But he said this fellow was going to move out of his White Bear home, and he was going to take an apartment. He had retired, and he had a great mass of personal property. He didn't know what to do with it, and he didn't want to sell it because he had attached too much sentiment to it. There was a mahogany, beautiful mahogany boat, and there was an enormous telescope. I think that had a lens about a foot size. It was a big thing. And he had all sorts of tools. Carpenter's tool, electrician's tool, blacksmith tools, a full set of everything. A great stamp collection. Oh, I could name stuff, just pick pages. He wanted me to have this, because he said he could go out and sell it, but it'd be like pulling a tooth every time he got rid of something. There was a whole set of micrometers in there, you know, those things cost a lot of money. And, so many things. And Florence here, she was stuck with this because I wasn't here to take care of this. So she had to go and get a moving van to haul this stuff up here. And that's probably part of her problem right now. She gets too many of those things through the ears, you know. People giving mahogany boats away. She should have taken the mahogany boat and launched it in this St. Croix River. Well, anyway, he got all this stuff, and I don't think he was in that apartment very long before he died. But in fact, I didn't even see him after that. I said I hadn't seen him for 20 years. In fact, I didn't see him after the first trip. But I use the old, I'm not a religious man, but I use an old statement that you throw crumbs on the water and it comes back loaves.
Well, I think